Session number 11212, reel 15.
Colonel R.B. Humphreys, reel 15. What was the role of the battalion in the early part of 1942 when you were back in England?
We went to do mountain warfare in Pontypool and thereabouts in Monmouthshire for 6 weeks intensive training down the valleys, picketing with mules and horses, and marching, a lot of marching. Then we swapped our CO, and Colonel Sanders came, who'd been G1 at Headquarters Northern Command, and he'd been on the frontier, and he was adjutant on the frontier when the 2nd Battalion went on the frontier before the war. So he knew a lot about it. Then we went back from there after 6 weeks, and we went back into Mid Wales, a place called Velindra, near Newcastle Emblem, between Newcastle Emblem and Carmarthen. And we set up in some old mills there, and we trained, and we looked towards the hills there. 52 Div were going to take over the main mountain warfare division, but we still, in 49, were going to be a mountain warfare division as well. And from there, we came into Herefordshire for some training under canvas in the summer. It's called Kington, where I got married. Then we went to North Wales, to the Bethgelert tan land, a place just near the bottom of Snowdon. And we trained there. And from there we went to up to Scotland. And by that time, Brigadier Sanders and Colonel Sanders had handed over to Colonel Rogers, who was very old, and we got a new div commander, Bubbles Barker, a very up-and-coming Monty man, and also a new brigadier, Cook Collis, both real desert Monty men. The Bubbles Barker came like a dose of salts, because although old Curtis was a very good diplomat in Iceland, he wasn't much good at the training side. He was a more diplomat historian general. And he went off to command something else. And so our intensive training, really, for D-Day started. We went out in boats and did a landings in the Kyles of Butte, and we did some very, very realistic night training and training in mountain warfare and in sea warfare up in Scotland, where we were for quite a time. Then that Christmas we went to Ulverston, in the Lake District, where we trained, went on training. And with a mountain warfare slant. Anyhow, then came the time when Guy Rogers was too old to command, and he was sacked by the DIF commander, this up-and-coming DIF commander. And Nigel Pert came in, and he'd been staff college and training at the War Office and right in the middle of things. He was an up-and-coming, wasn't going to last long, he said, when he came, 6 months, but he did last about 11. By that time, I was a company commander, and Hamilton was a company commander, and Lang was a company commander, Scotsman imported, nice man, B Company. Smallwood had A Company, my old company, and Grant had D Company, and I've forgotten who had S Company.
You still had headquarter company?
Yes. And we were there for quite a time. And then we, Alderston, we trained in the lakes. We were there. We were there over Christmas. I remember my wife came up. I was allowed to. But only wives weren't allowed really at all, just for Christmas. And Nigel Pratt, myself, she was living at the hotel in Alderston, and we spent Christmas night there. From there, we went back to South Wales. Then we more or less gave up the idea of being mountain warfare. The Canadians were going to, the 52 Div was going to do that. And we were training to go to North Africa. The landings in Algeria and around there. And then we were struck off that because the Canadians had seen very little except abortive raids, when one was a tragic one, Dieppe, and they wanted to go. So we were put onto the role of a reserve division for D-Day. And we trained from then on with that role in view. And we trained very hard.
What kind of training were you doing for this?
All kinds of assault training. This assault training was for D-Day, you see. And with boats and things. And also every sort of training to get us fit and right, going in on the right foot. Then we moved down to Thetford, where we went across from Thetford on D-Day. We were reinforced by a lot of officers from the Canlone, six of them who did very well. A lot of them got killed.
And what was this Canlone?
Well, Canadian officers, there were too many or something, and they came and made up our subalterns in the battalions. Well, quite a number of subalterns had to go out to the Middle East to reinforce 151 Brigade, who was still fighting there, of course, Alamein and Prima Soli, right into Italy. And Monty hadn't come home then. And then Monty came home, and he brought these people with him, and we got really mobilized for D-Day. Nobody knew when it was going to be.
When did you move to Thetford, do you recall?
Thetford. Just before Christmas, 43.
43.
Yes. Just before Christmas, 43. Now, 43 Christmas, we were up in Barrow and Furness. We must have, Alderston, we must have been just after. And then we have started intensive exercise. And of course, by that time 151 Brigade had been concentrated and sent out to the Middle East, and they'd gone to Pie Force to look after Persia. They did in that country, and then they came into
in your
Eighth Army.
In your training for D-Day, in effect, what kind of new equipment and new weapons were you meeting?
Oh, a lot of that was about then. We had assault boats and all kinds of things in the way of new. We still had the Piat, but new sort of weapons, mortars and things. Oh no, we were well equipped by that time.
Were you very happy with the standard of training and readiness of the battalion?
Yes, I think so. When the very big training came on, of course, you did things live, a lot of field firing live. And then I went on a battle course for battle school because they'd started up. And there they killed some people crawling under fire. That was in Barnard Castle, the battle course was. That was in the middle of 43. Then after that, Colonel Poet went, and Colonel Hanmer took over. And Colonel Jeffries had taken over 10th Battalion. So they had two regular officers. And Colonel Oxley had given over Tyneside Scottish, who was a TA, and Colonel De Winton, Gordon Highlander, had taken over. And it was Black Watch. It was all Black Watch. They wore Black Watch kilts and everything. And they got their reinforcements from Black Watch. We got our reinforcements from anywhere. Mostly, a lot of them from Geordies, but a lot of them from anywhere. And they fitted in very well. By this time, the depot was going flat out. Wounded officers coming back from all over the world and recuperating and being put back into service or having to leave the army or on light duties at Bransmouth. And Colonel McBain was commanding, and DLI. And we were, as I say, being reinforced to go across to France as a follow-up division of 50 Div. Monty was going all over the country, talking to the soldiers. The King came and talked to us. And
what was the message you were getting from Monty?
Oh, we will win. We will win. I'm going to command the Eighth Army. We will win. And of course, Churchill went out to Yalta, was it? And he sacked Auchinleck, and Wavell had already gone, and the disastrous Crete and Greek campaign had gone, and Singapore was falling. Had come in.
Did you get any lectures from anyone, you know, about the task that lay ahead of you?
Oh yes, many, from mostly Div Command and GOC and CR Command and different people. Monty reviewed everybody and talked to everybody. And he went round the factories and he went round all over the place. Prior to the invasion, we got more and more realistic and enormous exercises, embracing the whole of that part of England. We had one that started in Oxfordshire and we finished up fighting in Cambridgeshire, and right across England. And these were big exercises, and in some of the cases, soldiers were drawn, and the actual fire program was put down where it would be, and then the soldiers came back to their slit trenches. Highly dangerous. Div commander was nearly killed by a stray shot falling wide, and the brigadier was all over the place, very energetic. Well, then stony silence. We heard about Alamein, Adam Halfer and Alamein, and as they say, the Japs were absolutely wiped the floor in the Middle East, and they were in the Far East, and they were encroaching, and India was standing too, because they were frightened the Japs would invade India.
What effect was this kind of news having upon you yourselves? What effect was this kind of news coming through of all the successes elsewhere having upon you and yourselves?
All the failures. Oh, we were, I think, made us more determined to try and win through in Europe.
But the news of Alamein and the advance through the Middle East, did that make you feel that the invasion of Europe was that much closer?
Yes. Oh, yes. When they, especially when the two armies joined up, and we got to Primaceri Bridge and places like that.
As the time got nearer to the invasion, was the strain showing at all? Was there any strain with the anticipation of what you were going to have to face?
Yes, one, the unknown. For me, I'd never been in action, you see. For some people, it wasn't at all. 151 Brigade, who had come back from Italy and then gone out again, it wasn't for them at all. People like Ian English and people like that who'd seen masses of enemy fire, everything. And then the great D-Day happened, and we went over at D+4 behind 151 Brigade, who had already got a lodgement and were right down by Tilly-sur-Serle, fighting hard by that time.
Where did you sail from?
We sailed from New Haven, our little heart, in the middle of the night.
And had you moved close to New Haven prior to the
crossing? Yes. Yes, we had. And we were confined to barracks for 3 days, inoculations and all the kind of things, and getting up rolls of people and everything. Then when we got there, we got ashore quite easily, really, because there was, apart from shells falling in the water, trying to hit boats, the war had gone on, because 151 Brigade and 3 Div, and of course old Nigel had landed with his parachute brigade at First People of Laird and got the bridge, and the Americans were landing on the right, around Cherbourg, and the beaches were receiving stores from the Mulberry Harbour and everything, and the thing was in full gear.
What was the scene on the beaches when you actually landed?
Oh, there were a lot of hulks of things that had been knocked out in the assault, and also there were one or two dead bodies and things floating about and that sort of thing. We had to wade to get across the last bit. And it was a lovely sunny day. We landed and lay for quite a time. And then there were some desultory shelling and things. And then for us it was a sort of phony 3 days, because we marched inland. And we stopped at various places. And where we stopped, perhaps the shelling at night would be more intense, but there wasn't much fighting, because the fighting had gone on with the forward troops. And then we got into all hell let loose on the fourth day. when we went into a wood called Villas near Fontenay-le-Pinot. And that's where we got our first casualties. And people.
And was this in an attacking role that you went into this wood?
Yes.
You knew the Germans were there?
Yes. What happened was another battalion, another brigade, six Duke of Wellingtons, and rather panicked and left the wood, and we had to recapture it. There were Germans in it, and we lost our first officer, a Canadian, very nice Canadian, called Baker, on duty, patrolling. And then we went through the wood. We fought our way down to Rory, a place called Rory.
Can you recall, before we leave the wood, can you recall your particular role and that of your company in
the wood? I was on the right of the wood, clearing the right of the wood. I lost one or two soldiers, one or two killed, and no officers, I don't think, wounded there. And we went on down, and we had to get into Rory late at night. And there we were stuck because it was occupied by Germans. To begin with, we didn't think it was. A big fighting patrol was put in from another company, and it was lost in the middle of the night. So next morning at dawn, I was on the right, C Company on the left, forward, and B Company behind me, right, rear, and S Company, of course, all over the place.
And there, you still had headquarter company?
No, I had A Company.
You had A Company, I see.
Game by that.
And how were the Germans? What were the German positions in this place?
Well, they were mostly, they didn't come to light, really, until next day. And then they were trapped in trees. They were Hitler Youth. And it was corn, you see, a lot of corn, and a lot of bocage. So they were in trees. And as you advanced, this patrol of mine, Lieutenant Hoggard, took a fighting patrol in next morning. And as I was going forward with him to show him where to go, there was suddenly pss, pss, one went pss, right past me. And people started dropping. And they were strapped in trees, and they were not visible at all. And when they got to the village, of course, all hell was let loose. Hoggard did very well. He was wounded, but he was brought back. And half his patrol were either killed or taken prisoner. And as I say, one platoon of my company was rather written off. Then Colonel Hanmer on the left, on the right, put in a Major Bansal, who was B Company commander, and he went round through the corn on my right flank. I was holding, so was C Company. C Company had lost its second in command and CO, wounded, and second in command killed. No, D Company. They were forward, sorry. C Company had lost company commander wounded, and D Company, John Lowe, had been killed outright by a mortar bomb. Colonel Hanmer had his headquarters in a strip of trees by the road, and there was a nasty tank at a crossroad which had been knocked out, a German tank, by 151 Brigade as they went over through us. Then we could hear them fighting in front of us. And all hell was let loose at Rory. It's one of our major battle honours for 4 or 5 days. And the battalion was decimated. I think it's 14 officers killed and wounded, and about 300 men. A lot of them killed, too. By that time, the 10th battalion had been in on our right, and they'd got a bloody nose there in the the Bocage country, and the Tyneside Scottish were putting on our left. We were holding Rory Ridge. We gained Rory Ridge. And my company, the second command, unfortunately, fell off a carrier, broke his ankle, so had to be evacuated. Pop Ellison. One Canadian officer was wounded. Hoggard, wounded and died of wounds, and Price was killed. Another one. All trying to edge forward. I was lucky I got away with it. Had some very harrowing experiences of my runner coming back and being shot on the parapet and dying, bleeding into the trench, with his head lying in the trench and thing. And the signal was going bats, bomb happy. And the brigadier came up, and me, an enormously tall man, 6 foot six, he and I shared the trench together for a very nasty 2 hours of moaning minis, these awful mortars. And Talon did very well indeed. Well, it cool.
How do men stand up? Was that the worst weapon the German had that they were using, these minis?
Oh, no, 88s.
They were worse.
Oh, they were awful. And of course, these Hitler youth, they strapped themselves in trees and they didn't mind if they were killed. And in the corn, soldiers advancing through corn were just sitting ducks. But one didn't know there was so many enemy in the trees, otherwise one wouldn't have advanced that way. Anyhow, there we are. I was lucky to get away with it. We finished up and marched out. After 4 days, 5 days, 6 days, I expect, because we went over the top of the ridge and we held on there for a bit. And I was a one company commander to survive, B company commander being wounded, his second in command had been killed, all his officers had been killed. My officers, one had died of wounds, one had been killed, one had become a battle casualty, had to evacuate it, and one was wounded, a Canadian. So I was the only officer with A Company. B Company, there was no officers. C Company, the second in command, CO Smallwood, being wounded, the second in command was still alive. The D Company, company commander being killed, second command was still alive. He lost two company commanders, I think. And one was, no, second in command, yes, that was he was up in Rory, but he was mortally wounded because he lost his leg in the counterattack when the Germans put in the counterattack. And Sergeant Major Roxburgh commanded the company for a time and won the DCM doing it.
Were there any other men that you recall whose actions were particularly gallant that day?
Oh, yes.
Over that period?
Yes, I got Hoggard an MC, a posthumous one, and I got about three MMs people, and there was Sergeant Major Roxbury, DCM. My sergeant major did very well indeed.
What was his name?
His name was, who was he? Wait a minute. Samson. And then my colour sergeant did well. Can't remember his name. Oh.
Were there any men who didn't do well? Was there any men who...
One or two went bomb happy. One or two went completely bomb happy and had to be evacuated. They didn't run away or anything. They just went buried their heads in the sand and they wouldn't move and all that kind of thing. Colonel Hanmer did marvelously all over the place in the thick of firing and everything, so did the Brigadier. The Brigadier and he didn't get on well together. They didn't, they disliked each other. And Colonel de Winton, Tyneside Scottish, was the Brigadier's favourite. And he got the DSO in my way of thinking that Brigadier Hanmer ought to have had for the capture of Rory. He came in very much at the last moment.